I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Abu Anas Alibi is being detained and questioned by the U.S. military on a naval ship after being captured this past weekend by the Army's Delta Force with the assistance of the FBI in Tripoli, Libya. Alibi is a suspected al-Qaeda senior operative who's been on the FBI's most wanted list for his alleged involvement in the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. U.S. Special Forces had to call off an attack on a leader of al-Shabaab in Somalia this past weekend as well. That's the group that claimed responsibility for the recent massacre at a mall in Nairobi, Kenya. We begin today's show with Seth Jones to talk about al-Qaeda and their affiliates in Africa. He's author of a book called Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of al-Qaeda After 9/11. He's also associate director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Joined us from the studios of RAND. And Seth Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be on.
What's the significance of the capture of Alibi?
Well, I think the capture of Alibi and its significance will partly depend on how much information he is willing to divulge about his past activities in plotting attacks against U.S. infrastructure and his potential more recent activities in places like Libya. The second is any information on him, cell phone information, stuff that's in his pocket, notebooks on him that might be valuable for the collection analysis of intelligence.
I saw on CNN, actually, that his wife had claimed that he had left al-Qaeda in 1996. There's a long article in today's New York Times, interviews with his family members, including his son, who said essentially he had been kicked out of Libya because of his opposition to Muammar Gaddafi. He'd been held in harsh detention in Iran, raising questions about whether he really was a senior al-Qaeda operative. What do you say in response to that?
Well, I would say two things. One is there is apparently some information that he has been involved in trying to expand al-Qaeda's networks into Libya and other areas of North Africa. And the second, and probably the most important, is, I mean, look, Whitey Bulger was on the run from the FBI and U.S. law enforcement for many years for crimes that he had committed several decades before. So just because he may not have committed some crimes recently, I still think he should be held liable for his crimes committed in plotting attacks against U.S. infrastructure, including two U.S. embassies. And in and of itself, that'll be useful to talk to him about his involvement, how that stuff was and the attack was planned and executed.
Does it complicate things in that if it's true that he was fighting Gaddafi, and of course the United States had fought Gaddafi, that on some issues we have been on the same side as Alibi?
Well, in a sense, the U.S., the British, the French, and other governments did support the overthrow of the Gaddafi government. But at the same time, it's worth noting that in that particular insurgency against Gaddafi, that it was fairly decentralized. There were multiple groups, some directly trying to get rid of Gaddafi, some simply trying to use territory in Libya to expand their networks. And what we've seen with al-Qaeda in Libya, including al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, is they have used territory in Libya to expand their extremist version of Islam. So I wouldn't put too much on cooperation, certainly between the U.S. or other groups and Anas al-Libi.
What do we know, or perhaps what do you know, about al-Libi's involvement in those attacks on the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania? Now, that goes back to 1998. What do we know so far?
Well, very broadly, I'm aware of the alleged fact that he was involved in the plotting, in the planning, and in the execution of those attacks. In 1998, if all of us remember, was a time when there were some growing concerns about the role of al-Qaeda more broadly. But those two attacks, which targeted U.S. embassies, really put al-Qaeda on the radar of U.S. counterterrorism officials, and would be followed up 2 years later with the attacks against the USS Cole. So he was, again, allegedly involved in the planning of the attacks, from the target location to making sure the individuals and operatives were pushed onto into both Kenya and Tanzania for the operations.
Now, apparently there was a training manual that was found in his apartment by British authorities. Does that connect the dots for you?
No, that's one point of information. Again, what connects the dots would be a much broader collection of information gained by human intelligence interrogations, gained by signals intelligence collection, and based on a range of other intelligence that puts him in the inner circle of individuals involved in the plotting and the execution of the attack.
By human intelligence, I mean, you mean people on the ground that are talking to Americans and working with Americans?
It can be both American intelligence, so collected from U.S. assets or spies within Tanzania, within Kenya, and within North Africa more broadly, or it could be information provided by other government intelligence agencies.
He has been described as a computer expert. Is that helpful in understanding who he is?
Well, he certainly has technical capabilities in using the computer to download information, to look at target selections, to analyze potential locations to attack. I mean, in the embassy bombings, there's some indication that he was involved in analyzing the embassies. A lot of it was done via the computer. And we see that now in the use of even things like Google Earth by individuals like Anas al-Libi to conduct reconnaissance, surveillance, and intelligence about targeted attacks.
The Obama administration was criticized after the Benghazi attacks of a bit more than a year ago. Do you think this in any way helps, I guess, the reputation of the Obama administration in going after some of these suspects?
Well, I think it does show two things. One is it does show that the administration is interested in doing more than just killing people with drone strikes. Actually, in both the Somalia raid and in the Anas al-Libi raid in Libya, they were perpetrated by U.S. Special Operations Forces and other U.S. Agencies with boots on the ground. And one of the reasons was so that it limited the number of civilians, women, children, or men that were not involved in terrorist activities. It limited the civilian casualties. The second issue is, it does show again that there is a threat from al-Qaeda and affiliated groups in a range of these areas, and the U.S. is willing to pursue them, whether they're in Libya, whether they're in Somalia, whether they're in Yemen, or whether they're in other locations.
Does it raise questions about the drone program, or does it just say that there are certain missions that are better for human intelligence and the kind of thing that happened in Tripoli?
I think what it does show is that there is value in capturing somebody alive and collecting information on them or in the compounds they're in and then talking to them. And second, it does show the limitations of the drone program. When you drop a bomb, say shoot a Hellfire missile from a Predator or a Reaper drone, you kill or wound whatever is on the ground. There's a lot more precision if you set a team on the ground that can decide whether it wants to shoot or not and who. And when you drop a bomb, it hits who is ever in the compound. Mm.
And the drone program has been criticized for becoming a recruitment tool for organizations like al-Qaeda. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Well, that's a very difficult argument to assess. What you'd need to show is that individuals who otherwise would not have been interested in getting involved in terrorism, that was the main reason. I suspect in most cases, I mean, the limited evidence available suggests that there are a range of factors that contribute to radicalization. The use of drones, I suspect, is a very limited and minimally causal variable along those lines. But what it does do is it builds some animosity, as we've seen in Pakistan, against the U.S. And in Pakistan, I'll note that the issue has generally been less the use of drones and more the use of drones by the U.S. in what is considered sovereign territory.
What would you want to ask al-Libi if you were on the San Antonio where he's currently being detained?
Well, depending on his his involvement in al-Qaeda and affiliated networks, I would be interested in two things. I'd be interested in his involvement in past al-Qaeda attacks, including the 1998 attacks against the U.S. embassies in Africa. Second, I'd be deeply interested in his relationships with individuals, his sense of al-Qaeda's strategy, its operations, and its tactics across North Africa in an area that he is very familiar with. And regardless of how involved he is, he's likely to be aware of anyway just because of some of the individuals he interacts with.
And it is, I mean, you look at what happened in Nairobi, Kenya, Mali, other parts of Africa. Has al-Qaeda, whatever al-Qaeda is today, is it moving into parts of Africa?
I think there is no question that al-Qaeda first remains in Africa. It has several affiliates, groups that have sworn allegiance to the core in Pakistan, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in North Africa, al-Shabaab in Somalia, and then along the periphery, groups like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. They still exist. They still have the ability to conduct attacks in and around the region, as we saw recently in Nairobi. Second, there has been an increase in the number of Salafi jihadist groups. These are Sunni groups that are committed to the establishment of an extreme Islamic emirate in countries from Mali to Libya and Egypt now, and a number of others across Tunisia, across North Africa. Some of these are operate quite closely with al-Qaeda. So I would say al-Qaeda, A, exists, and B, it has a relationship with a growing number of very extremist organizations.
How would you compare the al-Qaeda of 2001 to the al-Qaeda of today?
I think the biggest difference is the decentralization of al-Qaeda. It has a very weakened core in Pakistan today, unlike in 2001. But it has a growing number of affiliates, groups that have sworn allegiance or bayat to it in multiple areas, most recently in Syria. But three, it is also decentralized. And unlike in 2001, people don't necessarily do what the leader of al-Qaeda in Pakistan says. At that time, it was bin Laden. Now it's Ayman al-Zawahiri. There's a lot more autonomy in how groups operate in various regions. And many of them, frankly, are not targeting the United States, at least the U.S. homeland, for terrorist attacks. They're more interested in parochial fights.
And we're almost having a break here, but more interested in what, local grievances?
What you see in if you look at the patterns of attacks by groups like al-Shabaab, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, is the vast majority of their fighting, the vast majority of their targeted killing and assassinations is done against locals, local Yemeni government officials, local Somalis. In the case of al-Shabaab recently in Nairobi, it was against the Kenyans and Kenyan civilians, and the Kenyans have been among the predominant militaries that have been fighting al-Shabaab in Somalia. So they're really local fights that is targeted.
We are talking with Seth Jones in the first half of this hour of Radio Times today, author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11. He's with the RAND Corporation, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY and is proud to announce that Chester County Hospital is now part of Penn Medicine, extending the resources and knowledge of the Academic Medical Center to Chester County. To learn more, chestercountyhospital.org/Penn.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra under Raphael Frubeck de Burgos performs Respighi's The Pines of Rome, Beethoven's Eighth Symphony, and with Lise de La Salle, Franz Liszt's Second Piano Concerto. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. October 17th, 18th, and 19th at the Kimmel Center, Beethoven and the Pines of Rome with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, new music out of Los Angeles, from Beck to a newcomer, singer Banks.
I got this thing for you. Come closer, I can whisper in your ear.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. On newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Seth Jones, author of a book that came out not so long ago called Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11. We asked him to join us today on Radio Times after the capture of al-Libi in Tripoli, Libya today. He's currently being detained on a naval ship, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and we'll read your email on the air. Seth Jones, would you say because of the Arab uprising, and of course it's been different in different countries, but many, many changes in Northern Africa and also parts of the Middle East, that that has attracted al-Qaeda and its affiliates to that part of the world?
I think there are probably two reasons why al-Qaeda and other extremist Sunni groups have established a foothold in areas from North Africa through the Middle East. One is the Arab uprisings. And as much as many of us wanted to see the spread of democracy, and I think in general it is a good thing, what we have seen in countries like Libya is that what has come after the overthrow of regimes is very weak central governments with limited control over especially rural areas, and that has provided an opportunity for groups like al-Qaeda and others to establish a foothold. The second is what we see across some areas of the Middle East is a growing sectarian fighting. Syria is a good example of this, so is Lebanon, of fighting between Shia and Sunni, and it's driven this hatred among both sides. And added funding, fighters, and state support from Iran on one side and many of the Gulf states on the other. And that's allowed groups like al-Qaeda to get more money, more fighters, more weapons.
Is there popular support for al-Qaeda in parts of this region we've been talking about?
Well, the challenge that al-Qaeda faces is that its brand of Islam is not particularly popular. So I think what we see in most areas that al-Qaeda operates is, A, it operates in a vacuum. B, it may have limited support for its extremist ideology. And the goal really is to support an extreme version of Sharia law or Islamic law in countries. But C, what we also see is where al-Qaeda is able to establish some territorial control, it usually does it with some form of coercion or intimidation. And so not a lot of popular support, but more taking advantage of vacuums, using local allies, and then essentially trying to kill a number of people to establish control.
And less focused on the United States, do you think?
Again, it depends on the affiliate or organization. With some groups like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, it has been willing to target the U.S. homeland to take airliners down. In a few others, in cases like al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in North Africa, potential interest in targeting U.S. embassies in the region, but little evidence of supporting an attack in the U.S. homeland. And there, to be frank, in North Africa, one of the biggest enemies are states like the French, with a history of getting involved in North Africa.
And we saw that in Mali, yes?
We saw that in Mali, and that's why the French got involved directly in the fight against Ansar al-Din, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and some of the Tuareg insurgents in Mali. And that's also why the U.S. supported the French involvement. They've got a history of operating in this region. They are probably the main external enemy of many of these groups, and they have the capability to conduct operations, which they did fairly effectively.
I'm curious about, and we don't know quite as much about the mission that was called off to try to target a head of al-Shabaab in Somalia. Interestingly, we're on the 20th anniversary of Black Hawk Down. Does Somalia pose a whole different set of challenges?
Well, Somalia is most interesting because there are a number of individuals over the past 5 or 6 years from American cities like Minneapolis, Phoenix, including northern cities like Buffalo that have traveled to Somalia to fight with al-Shabaab. We've had several suicide bombers that are Americans blow themselves up. Shabaab has not been interested at this point anyway in targeting the U.S. homeland, But it certainly appears to be interested in targeting U.S. Civilians in and around East Africa and kidnapping, possibly targeting U.S. embassies. And again, the flow of Americans, especially from Somali American communities in the U.S., is a cause for some concern.
And what do you think should be done about that?
Well, I think as long as al-Shabaab is predominantly interested in targeting the Somali government and neighbors, the focus of the U.S. really should be supporting the Somali government and then neighbors like Kenya, Djibouti, and other African countries involved in fighting Shabaab. And that really means building the capacity of those security services, building civilian capacity to establish control and deliver services, and let those governments be the tip of the spear where the U.S. is generally supporting them in the background. But I think it would be very damaging for the U.S. to take a direct role and a major role for the most part in these kinds of countries.
Should we think about the quote-unquote war on terrorism as a kind of cold war, or should we think of al-Qaeda and its affiliates as a bunch of mobsters and to deal with them as mobsters, as criminals?
I think most of these al-Qaeda operatives and other extremists are criminals in many ways. They're involved in a range of criminal activity from illegal cigarette smuggling to illegal charcoal smuggling. They're involved heavily in prostitution and human trafficking. Many of them are not particularly religious or certainly don't abide by even Muslim principles, despite the fact that they say they do. They are more criminals than anything else.
So, I mean, should that be then the approach of the United States?
Well, there certainly is a law enforcement response that's necessary against some of these organizations. But to be frank, some of them, including al-Shabaab and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, do have military capabilities. They are fighting ground battles against governments in their areas. So part of the response also needs to be taking them on in ways that counter them. And if they're going to use heavy weapons, if they're going to try and take control of areas, then it may be helpful in adopting some military tactics and strategies against them in addition to law enforcement. Part of this is some combination of both.
But do you also see this as a war of ideas, a war of values between the West and these extremist groups?
If we go back to the Cold War, I would say one of the lessons that I take from the Cold War against the Soviet Union is that the struggle against Moscow was just as much about the struggle over Marxism-Leninism as it was about a battlefield struggle against the Soviets in Latin America and Asia and Africa. One of the things I think the U.S. has done quite poorly over the past several years is recognize the importance of this media and information campaign and respond to it effectively. And the head of al-Qaeda today, Ayman al-Zawahiri, said several years ago that at least half of the struggle, at least from al-Qaeda's perspective, is a struggle in the media. It's an ideological one. I think they're further along than we are in recognizing this.
Using what, Twitter? Is that what we're talking about?
They use Twitter. They use a range of social media forums. They clearly use the internet, MySpace, Facebook, to recruit individuals, to fundraise, to radicalize. And what they're able to do is with a very small number of individuals to influence and shape the minds of impressionable young Muslims.
And you think the U.S. can counter those messages using social media as well?
Well, I think what the U.S. has to be a little careful here. The U.S. is not viewed as an objective actor in many of these countries, but what the U.S. can do is support legitimate individuals. We saw in Saudi Arabia, for example, between 2003 and 2007, al-Qaeda was decimated in an effort to overthrow the Saudi regime. Part of it was using legitimate Sunni clerics who, including the Grand Mufti, who issued fatwas or religious edicts against al-Qaeda and really gutted the popular support within Saudi Arabia for al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups. So I think what the U.S. can do in many of these countries is support legitimate actors that push back against this extremist interpretation, and there is room to do that.
But we have to know who these people are, yes?
We have to know who these people are. We have to work with the countries within which we're operating, whether it's Somalia or Yemen or Libya. And so it can't be done alone. And I think in many places it can't be done really as a U.S. lead. I think that's bound to be more counterproductive than it will be productive.
Well, Seth Jones, thank you so much for getting our conversation started today in this hour of Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. He's author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11, joined us from the studios of the RAND Corporation, where he is Associate Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center. Well, we want to talk about some of the international legal and domestic issues raised by the capture of Al-Libi. And joining us now is Deborah Perlstein. She's an assistant professor of international and constitutional law at Cardozo Law School, that's in New York. She was part of the first group of human rights monitors granted access to observe military commission proceedings at Guantanamo Bay back in 2004. And Deborah Perlstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And to our listeners, again, any questions or comments you might have, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Deborah, I was talking with Seth Jones about the capture of Libya over the weekend in Tripoli. Does the United States have the right to go into another country and grab someone who has been indicted in this country?
Well, so there are two ways of answering that question. One is as a matter of U.S. domestic law, and the other is a matter of international law, and we need to comply with both. The United States certainly has ample authority under its own domestic law to seize Libby and then prosecute him, but it's pretty clearly a violation of international law to go into a foreign sovereign nation without that nation's consent and essentially seize or kidnap one of their citizens off the streets and bring him back here. Now, there's a big open question, and we just don't know the answer, whether or not Libya in fact consented to this operation, or at least secretly consented to the operation. But if they didn't, then it's a pretty serious violation of international law.
And can anything be done against the United States if it is a violation?
Well, it's interesting. Libya, of course, has a variety of diplomatic means at its disposal, but traditionally the remedy under international law for a violation like that is for a country to seek the return of its seized national. And to my knowledge, Libya hasn't yet demanded publicly that the United States return Al-Libi to him. If they don't do that, that might be an interesting indication that there was an arrangement, at least a private arrangement, that with the Libyans that this operation could go ahead.
Do you think when Congress voted back in right after September 11th, back in 2001, voted for the authorization for the use of military force, essentially saying we are at war with Al-Qaeda, and that enables us to go and find and perhaps even kill, in the case of Osama bin Laden, its followers and its leadership. Does that still hold when it comes to someone like Al-Libi?
Well, it's interesting. Al-Libi is probably one of the few people who Congress, if you had to imagine, might have anticipated would have been covered by the authorization for the use of military force. He's been under indictment, criminal indictment, in the United States since 2000, accused of his role in the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Africa back in 1998. He was named as part of an original indictment against bin Laden and a bunch of core Al-Qaeda leaders. So he might be one of few people Congress might have anticipated, although probably not this far distant in the future, would still be covered. Operations like the one that was carried out the same day in Somalia, that's a much more complicated question. And it's really unlikely that Congress anticipated that, you know, 12 years out, the United States would be using that same authority to go into Somalia and seize, or at least try to seize, somebody who is part of a group that really didn't exist as a terrorist organization when the attacks of 9/11 happened.
So even if Al-Shabaab has some kind of affiliation with Al-Qaeda today, what you're saying, Deborah, is that they didn't have that affiliation back in 2001.
Well, they didn't. It's pretty clear. Al-Shabaab grew up, was born as a sort of domestic Somali insurgency group, later has become to some degree associated with al-Qaeda. We don't know really to what extent that is, and we especially don't know with respect to this particular individual who they were going after, who seems to have been responsible for the terrible mall bombings in Kenya a couple of weeks back. It's particularly unclear what his association with al-Qaeda is. There are elements of al-Shabaab that are associated with al-Qaeda. There are elements that are really not, and the Kenyan mall bombing was pretty clearly in retaliation for Kenya's participation or involvement in the internal Somalian civil war. So to what extent this was about a response to that bombing, and to what extent this was about some sort of ongoing affiliation with al-Qaeda, is really unclear based on what we publicly know.
Now, I read that some Americans or people with associations to America were injured in that mall attack. Does that change things legally at all?
Well, so again, in the Somalia case, there are two kinds of questions. One is, does the president have domestic authority under this, under a statute or under the Constitution to do what he did, to order the attack that he did? And the second question, is it lawful under international law? In the Somalia case, I think there is an easier argument that it was lawful under international law if the United States was acting effectively in self-defense in response to the attack in the Kenyan mall bombing, and with concern that that group might pose an ongoing threat to the United States or its interests in the region. It's a much harder case, in my view, to argue that the president had domestic legal authority. Because, for the reasons I mentioned, it's harder to argue, although the administration has done it before, that the AOMF extends to members of al-Shabaab in Somalia, which would leave the president's inherent authority under Article 2 of the Constitution, an inherent authority presumably to act in the national security interests of the United States in using force without congressional authorization. But that, too, would be a complex argument for the administration to make. And while it may be possible for them to make it, what is one of the most concerning things here is that we're sort of left to speculate in the absence of real information, not about the operations per se, but just about the legal theories that justified them.
We're almost having a break here, but al-Libi is being detained on an American ship, a naval vessel, and not on land somewhere. Is that significant, the fact that he's in the Mediterranean and not in a country? Is that a significant legal issue?
Well, potentially, and there are a couple of legal issues there. One legal issue is, how long will he be held there, and how are the conditions of his treatment while he's there? We know from the federal court's treatment of individuals like Ahmed Warsami, who was a Somalian captured by the United States in the Gulf of Aden, held on a ship for a number of weeks, up to 2 months, and then prosecuted in federal court here in New York, that the federal court said, look, the fact that he was held is not an obstacle to his criminal prosecution. That analysis might change if he's held for an indefinite length of time, a much longer period of time, and it might change if there are concerns about the access of the Red Cross to him to make sure his health and his treatment are satisfactory.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Deborah Perlstein, also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org.
Independence Seaport Museum supports WHYY and will host its annual Old City Seaport Festival October 11th through 13th on Penn's Landing. Visitors can take deck or river tours aboard the tall ships or participate in the pirate battle on the Delaware. The festival also features live music, a craft village, and the Gosling's Dark and Stormy Tavern. The Pirate's Lair, sponsored by Metro Kids Magazine, features activities for kids. Information and tickets at phillyseaport.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Elizabeth Smart talks about surviving her 9-month ordeal after she was kidnapped from her bedroom when she was 14 by a man who saw himself as a prophet and wanted her as his second wife. He repeatedly raped her. Her story remained in the news until his capture. Now she has a foundation dedicated to preventing child abuse, and she has a memoir. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
At some point, you've just got to end it.
Let this be known.
that we who made the noise do now the silence own.
Books have endings. Even government shutdowns have endings. All things, in fact, a scientific truth we'll explore with Radiolab hosts Jed Abumrad and Robert Krolwich next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me just recap. U.S. efforts to capture terror suspects last weekend in Africa had some mixed results. There was an unsuccessful raid on an alleged member of al-Shabaab in Somalia, while in Tripoli, the FBI and Special Forces captured Abu Anas al-Libi, thought to be a senior al-Qaeda operative. He's reportedly being detained and questioned on a naval ship. And Deborah Perlstein is an assistant professor of International and Constitutional Law at Cardozo School of Law in New York. She was part of the first group of human rights monitors granted access in 2004 to observe military commission proceedings at Guantanamo Bay. Lines open for any questions or comments you might have. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. And again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Deborah, let me just read an email that we got from a listener, Mark, and this has to do with whatever questioning or interrogating is going on this ship, wanting to know whether you think the U.S. has learned from our mistakes from past interrogations. And of course, the Obama administration has said that we would not involve ourselves in harsh interrogations. Is there any way to know whether we're doing that or not?
So there's very little way from the outside to know, but there's some important signs that we have and that we should look for in the current operation. The signs that we have are all good indications. When Obama came into office, one of his first acts was to issue an executive order saying we weren't going to pursue these torture and cruel treatment tactics and interrogation anymore, to reinforce the U.S. and international law prohibitions on those tactics, and then to form a new high-value interrogation group, which is made up of officials from not only the intelligence agencies like CIA, but also FBI and other law enforcement agencies that have long-standing experience in conducting effective interrogations without resort to unlawful techniques. So that's certainly a good sign, and we haven't had any major allegations of violations of these rules in the last number of years. But the most important sign to look for in the current circumstances is whether and when the the U.S. government grants the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, access to the detainee who's held on the ship. It's able to grant that access. It's done so in the past, and that would be the single most important step that it could take to demonstrate that it was making sure that the treatment of al-Libi was in compliance with U.S. and international law.
He's described as an enemy combatant. Does he have any rights?
Well, that term enemy combatant has been used for a long time, and it has never had any really specific meaning, or its meaning varies depending on who you ask. In this case, right, he's held under the authority of the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, which is the same authority that the individuals held at Guantanamo Bay are currently detained under. The Supreme Court has held that those detainees have access to the federal courts to challenge the legality of their detention. It's unclear whether Mr. al-Libi would have the same rights recognized, although it's very likely, almost no matter where he's held, if he is in U.S. custody, that those rights would be recognized. But I think what seems most likely to happen, what I hope is most likely to happen here, is that he will be reasonably promptly brought here to New York to stand criminal trial, in which case he will be afforded the full panoply of rights available to criminal defendants in this country.
Let me quote something that Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican, said in a statement. He said, "I believe the most responsible course of action would be to hold him, al-Libi, as an enemy combatant at Guantanamo Bay for intelligence gathering purposes. U.S. Navy ships were never intended to be confinement and interrogation facilities in the war on terror. The use of ships instead of Guantanamo Bay will greatly compromise our ability to gather intelligence from captured terrorists." Do you agree with that?
No. I think it would be an enormous mistake to send him to Guantanamo for a variety of reasons. One, I think we've showed that the I think the administration and others have shown over the period of the last 10 years that the combination of preliminary interrogation before being subject to criminal prosecution briefly, followed by submission through the criminal justice system, is an enormously effective way of gathering intelligence. In fact, probably the most effective means we've had, because you have the full weight of the criminal justice system, the ability to strike bargains with detainees who then, as Warsami did, become enormously cooperative with federal interrogators. So that's reason one. I think we will be more effective in gaining intelligence from this person if we bring him into the criminal justice system. The second reason, and it's the biggest one, is Congress has made it close to impossible to get anybody out of Guantanamo Bay. So once people are in, they have prohibited transferring them out for something like criminal prosecution. And the result has been that you have this ongoing, long-term, not only stain on the United States human rights record, but real strategic liability in our international counterterrorism efforts. Not only our enemies use Guantanamo and its existence as a recruiting tool, but our allies find it difficult to cooperate with us in counterterrorism efforts because of the legal questions, the ongoing legal questions surrounding the detentions there. So we not only, I think, don't gain anything by sending them there, but we risk losing a lot when right in front of us, we have an option that's been used dozens and, in fact, hundreds of times since 9/11 of actually prosecuting this guy criminally, and in the course of that, gaining a lot of intelligence that we hope he may have.
You know, I have to say I was surprised in doing some homework for today's show, looking at the Justice Department track record on alleged terrorists or finding them guilty versus the Department of Defense, and something like 350 terrorists have been found guilty and are now serving time in three American prisons.
The U.S. criminal justice system has been dramatically effective in pursuing terrorism prosecutions, including prosecutions of a number of American nationals who are believed to have aligned with or supported al-Shabaab in Somalia. By far our most effective way of capturing and securing the long-term detention of that particular terrorist group. So I think there's little question. In fact, as time has passed since 9/11, the courts have become better and better at those cases, dealing with complex questions of how do you handle classified information, how do you deal with people who have been detained under law of war authority initially, because they've accumulated a great deal of experience from before 9/11, certainly with the embassy bombings, the first World Trade Center bombings back in the 1990s, and certainly by today, they are, I think, the best experts we have in how to secure the long-term detention of terrorist suspects.
But what's so interesting is with that track record, and it's a pretty impressive track record, there are still calls to send people to Guantanamo Bay.
Well, it's interesting, and it's frustrating and troubling for many people on both sides of the aisle who have studied and worked on these issues over the past decade and more. The rationale for maintaining Guantanamo Bay and keeping it open has become very difficult to pin down. Now, there's a rational argument there, which is there will be some captures of terrorists. We do need some place to hold them, right? And if not Guantanamo, we're holding them at least briefly on Navy ships, and that's not ideal either from a host of perspectives. So that's a rational and important argument that needs to be considered. But given the cost, the tactical counterterrorism cost that we suffer from keeping Guantanamo Bay open, and given the other options that are available, it's not an argument that either of the past two presidents or the past presidential candidates have found, particularly John McCain, have found persuasive. And you have a raft of senior military leaders lined up on the side of it's time to close it as well. I think the single most compelling argument that members of the House and some of the Senate find compelling about keeping Guantanamo open is to do with this notion that, well, they're terrorists, they don't deserve treatment in regular criminal trial. And I certainly understand the instinct, but the reality is that we're shooting ourselves in the foot if we don't use the criminal all the instruments of U.S. national power to fight these folks. And the criminal justice system is one of the most powerful instruments we have.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, that's Deborah Pearlstein, our second guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's an assistant professor of international and constitutional law at Cardozo Law School in New York, joining us from her cell phone. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we make it to the 11 o'clock hour. And we are talking about the capture of Alibi, a suspected senior level of Al-Qaeda in Tripoli, Libya. He's currently being detained on a Navy ship and being interrogated or about to be interrogated. And we're talking about some of the legal implications involved in all that. And, of course, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And, again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Deborah, I have to say, doing some preparation for today's show, and you mentioned this person, Ahmed Warsami, seems to be a significant case that has some possible connections to what might happen with Alibi. Help us understand who this person is.
So Ahmed Warsami was in many respects similar to the, or at least related to the raid that was just carried out in Somalia. He was a member, or is accused to have been a member of Al-Shabaab, the same terrorist organization that the United States was going after, apparently, in its Somalia attack a few days ago. And he was picked up literally on the seas in the Gulf of Aden and held on a ship for 2 months' time, where he was interrogated before being brought here to the United States, where he eventually entered into a plea agreement and has become, according to the law enforcement and intelligence officials who have been a part of his case, one of the boon for U.S. intelligence operations and understanding the nature of Al-Shabaab and that that organization. There were a host of questions at the time about the length of his detention, but a singular difference between Warsami's case, I think there are two differences here, Warsami's case and Alibi's case. Mm-hmm. One difference is that we know, at least to some extent, what's going on with Alibi. We know the fact of his capture at the time of his capture, and that makes it, or may make it at least somewhat easier for international monitors, for Americans, to keep track of what the United States is doing with him, and that's better from a human rights and justice point of view. The other difference is it's easier to understand, as I said earlier, in the case of Alibi, what the U.S. domestic legal justification is for detaining him, whereas in Warsami's case, it was much less clear, at least initially, what it was they were trying to accomplish and how it was that he fit within the authorization for the use of military force.
The same question I asked Seth Jones earlier in the hour, but do you think that the capture of Alibi does raise questions about the limits of the U.S. drone program?
Well, I think there have always been questions about the limits of the U.S. drone program and about, in some respects, the legality of the U.S. drone program. No one thinks that the United States, there's too many negatives, the United States certainly on some occasions has the authority under domestic law and is justified under international law in using lethal force. The big billion-dollar question there has always been, what are those circumstances? And it would have raised extremely difficult questions in both of these cases about whether or not the United States could have used lethal force, particularly in Libya, and particularly without that nation's consent. The use of lethal force on Libyan soil to kill Alibi would have been likely, again, without Libyan consent, a violation of our obligations under the UN Charter. That's a treaty the United States and every other country in the world is a party to. It prohibits one state from using armed force against another state without that sovereign state's consent. And that's been an issue with respect to U.S. uses of force in Pakistan, in Yemen, although both of those nations are thought to have at least secretly consented to some of those operations, but it would have been an enormous question with respect to the government of Libya. And similarly, in Somalia, questions about the use of drones and the Somali government, such as it is, consent, would have arisen again here. But the larger issue, I think, with both of these individuals, and the reason the administration has always said it prefers capture to killing, is because if you kill them, you lose a potentially very valuable source of intelligence, particularly in al-Libi's case. If this is the man that we believe he is, he is probably a font of information. His association with al-Qaeda dates back to the 1990s. He would be potentially a very valuable source of information for the United States, and it would have been a loss in that respect to simply kill him, in addition to raising a host of really, really difficult legal questions that the United States should be worried about.
Deborah, almost out of time here, but do you think there's a need for a new authorization for the use of military force, which was passed just about, 12 years ago?
Well, it's interesting. We're going to have a conference here on that very topic at Cardozo in about a week's time that was scheduled weeks and weeks before this. So I'll know more about my answer to that question soon. But my instinct is no, and for the following reasons. The al-Qaeda that attacked us on 9/11 is, in the words of former Secretary of Defense Panetta, it's been decimated. And most U.S. counterterrorism experts think that. There are many threats in the world to the United States. They are in some respects similar, in some respects different. But it's not at all clear that the regular use of military force, that continuing on, as the president says, a war footing indefinitely is the best and most effective way to combat them. In fact, I think not having that authorization applicable may be the best incentive we have toward moving toward other mechanisms for fighting this threat.
Well, Deborah Perlstein, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. She's an assistant professor of international and constitutional law at Cardozo Law School in New York. We began our conversation with Seth Jones, author of a book called Hunting in the Shadows. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back.